Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and power athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. Joining him is everyone's favorite coach and hair model, Chris, aka Tex McQuilkin, Power Athlete's Director of Performance. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
Hey, yeah. Welcome to another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Yes, we welcome a special guest in studio, master stone builder John Aguilar, an innovator of modern stonecraft.
Right on. Thanks, guys.
Nice. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, this is not your first trip to Power Athlete. You were out here with friend of Power Athlete now, I suppose, Brian Callen, comedian.
He's an old friend. He's a big fan of Power Athlete.
He does follow us.
Yeah, he has to. So I've been sending in dick pics, not my dick,
but dick pics. I'm just
randomly sending him that stuff. But you met him because I think you were on his podcast.
So he used to have a podcast called Mixed Mental Arts. That's right. You listen to it. So 2017, he was on with Hunter Motz was his partner. I reached out, we were in Santa Barbara at the time because I was working on this project in Truckee. I reached out to Hunter Motz because I heard him on Joe Rogan about tutoring.
Wait, you were living in Santa Barbara but doing a project in Truckee?
Flying back and forth.
Oh, I was going to say, that's a hell of a drive.
Yeah, flying just on weekends because.
Yeah.
And then, so we had reached out, I reached out to Hunter, who was Brian's Mixed Mental Arts podcast partner. About tutoring our kids because my two oldest, we were homeschooling them. Because that's kind of what he specialized in. So I met Hunter down in LA, and then that turned into a conversation about stone. And then I did the first one. Somehow we ended up talking about stone on Mixed Mental Arts. And then I went and did a second one with him and Brian at Brian's house back in early 2018. So that's how I met Brian. And then, that was a great podcast. I don't know why they still don't know why they dropped it.
Yeah, coincidentally, I listened to that episode with John and Callen way back when.
Well, I think maybe things just get stale after 653 episodes. Maybe you just got to change it up.
Well, I don't even know if they got to that. But it was.
Yeah.
It was enlightening.
The stone builder, stone mason, and I know we've got into a little bit of the nuance in terms of like, lexicon in terms, hey, one is whetstone, you're into dry stone. Can you give people a greater understanding of, more importantly, what you do, how you do it, and the historical significance? Because for me, I'm always fascinated by some of these lost arts, the fact that we don't have the technology to build the pyramids. I mean, so there were master stone builders, not only architects. I mean, the amount of not only mathematics and geometry. I mean, it's fucking fascinating to me. So when I met you and you kind of explained it a little bit, I felt like there was a tie to probably something that more people have forgotten than people know.
Yeah. So I always like to do schema enhancement for people. So for someone who's never heard about this before. So first of all, dry stone means you build without mortar. So it's 100% stone. It's real simple. And even people, when I say that, still ask me, where's the rebar? Where's the concrete? So Dry stone means building without just 100% stone. In wet masonry, or I call it traditional masonry, is when you use mortar, whether it's a hot lime or it's standard mortar. So you're using that to adhere. So it allows, you know, there's a time and place for everything. I'm not a purist, like it has to be one or the other. It's a time and place for concrete. But I chose dry stone because what I've realized over the last few years is I'm more of an artist. So on projects, I lead with my artist hat and I build with my stone builder hat. I used to think the other way because I started off in landscaping as a contractor. So the way I explain it to people is, dry stone's that, wet stone's this, or wet masonry is this. What happened, kind of historically, the quick timeline is, we have, you're talking about the wonders of the world. I've been to the pyramids and places like this those builds predated an era. There's, great event, whether it's Younger Dryas or something like that. I mean, it depends on what you believe. I'm a Younger Dryas advocate that event happened.
What are you talking about? The last ice age? The Great Flood?
Yep.
Yeah. Which is actually interesting. And I think because it was written about in the Bible with Noah, modern historians have just discounted it because the Bible, of course, can't be historically accurate. But every civilization, if you go back far enough, has some incident of some form of great flood, like, the sinking of Atlantis, Noah and the great flood in the ark. I mean, that is historical within it. I mean, even for the the Magic of Egypt, the series that the geologist guy went to look at the Sphinx and like show the water erosion.
Graham Hancock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson, they both have, they worked together. I think those guys have definitively proven this event and these, the outcome of that. So, you have all that past great monumental building and then you have the Romans did what I call imperial masonry. They built with purpose. I mean, they did fantastic stuff. I call it imperial masonry because they had aim, ambition, and purpose. So, the Appian Roads,
they're still used to this day.
Yeah.
I can't drive on the highway without hitting a pothole. Mm-hmm. And yet you go to Europe and there's Roman roads that are still actively used.
Yeah, the aqueducts. I took the boys and we went to Turkey, Spain, Italy. We climbed on the aqueducts. All these things still exist. So I call that imperial masonry. Then you have, and what happened then, there's a steady decline. And that gets into we're going to have to talk about beauty at some point as a human need. And then where we're at now in that kind of long arc of history is, to me, it's kind of like we're in the Dark Ages. And so what I'm after, this has been a slow process because we can talk about how I got into this in a little bit, but I didn't start doing anything with dry stone until I was 39. And that happened at a workshop. I was kind of called, so to speak. But the whole purpose of what I'm doing right now, I chose dry stone purposely just because it was the parameters on it where you have to stick to the old ancient rules. They're so strict that that's very inviting to have, what I describe dry stone to some people, it's subjective engineering meets art. Subjective engineering is the old rules. That's that, these are what I call the sacred rules that were developed long, long time ago. The art is my expression. It's my style. Okay. So now we're in this point where what I like to say is too many guys who are in the stone building world are living under the shadow of the past great builders. And I don't mean that I think it's a negative, like where everybody's looking backwards, like, wow, look what they built. Look what they did, as if we don't have some sort of potential capacity ourselves, but we have technology that didn't exist then, and we have potential. We can do things. I mean, there's some projects I'd love to do that have never been built before. There are some forms that have never been built historically before. Everything structural has been built. Pyramids, kind of think of building structures, stone upon stone upon stone. One form that's never been built, there's never been any historical count or finding as just think of a portal, moon gate, at scale. There's no account of that being built beyond a traditional Chinese garden wall ever. There's no remnants. There's no historical counts. There's nothing that stands today. I have a theory on why that wasn't built, but everything else has been built. So that's kind of, you know, where I'm at is in my own little way is thinking in the future. I'm very future oriented about what's possible. And that's, you know, where I'm at right now. Literally, we were talking about this morning. I'm kind of in this new, you know, point moving down to Texas. I see things are so much bigger here, and the possibilities is I'm trying to explore how to go next level with what's possible and what can be done with technologies. And while so many guys are just looking at the past, and I like reading about, you know, what Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson, these guys do, but I'm not that interested in the backwards thing. That's great, but I'm just more for, does that make sense?
It makes a ton of sense. I think what I find a bit confusing is like the definitive nature of history where we don't know. I mean, to say that there wasn't some form of highly advanced civilization that existed and then got pounded into the sands of time that we just haven't found, it seems preposterous to me that people won't kind of grant that.
One thing that's wild is I was talking with some guy about this the other day, and you go to any of my job sites that I built over the last 18 years, any guys, there's going to be, if you're 300 years out from now and you go back to any of my job sites, it's so easy to do like forensics on it. You'll find shards. You'll find some of us leave tools or chisels inside the wall. We leave things in there kind of as little,
capsules.
Kind of time capsules. Yeah. Some people will even do a time capsule, but I've always purposely left things in there. Just, you know, but you go to these pyramids or I was in Peru 2 years ago. I was in
Machu Picchu.
I never make it to Machu Picchu because it was right before the lockdown. So I was in Sacsayhuaman in Cusco because I was there to do ayahuasca. But there's no remnants. There's no tools left. I don't even think a lot of these places, there's not even stone shards. And you'll find that at any of our job sites.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea, man. No idea.
Well, I mean, they found the quarries where the stone came from for Egypt. And if you go down the Nile, there's actually test sites. There's lesser known pyramids, and they have some really interesting things that they can't explain. Like they have these huge fire pits, and they found a way to effectively heat the granite in such a way that they could cut it, which we still don't know how they did it because that technology doesn't necessarily exist. Or even the mortar, which they don't know, you know, what it's composed of. We can't remake it. So, I mean, there's some fascinating stuff where we see evolution. But like with a lot of these things, I just think that maybe, you know, time or the jungle or different things have just, I mean, like, you know, what is it? A Göbekli? I don't know. I'm butchering that name.
Göbekli.
Yeah. Göbekli.
I think it's in Turkey.
Yeah. I mean, that was like finding 747 underneath the pyramid. Yeah. I mean, there were stone structures that were so monolithic, these amazing things at a time that they date to where we didn't have the wheel. So they say. You know, man was still scratching his ass as a hunter gatherer. And then all of a sudden they have this incredible monolithic deal that just pops out of nowhere that they have no explanation for. And instead of being like, hey, we don't know anything, they just kind of like avoid it.
Yeah. I mean, in Peru, you know, there's a belief or in some, I don't know if it's been proven, but it looks like the stones it was softened and it became malleable to shape it.
Because, well, and then the other one we talked about, this is the one that I can't figure out on Machu Picchu because they know where the stones came from. They have no rope marks. There's nothing like all of a sudden they somehow found a way to levitate stones. And I think we discussed it that either they had some form of balloons or sound or something crazy.
Sound?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ask him about it. We talked about this because I always ask because like one of the things that I was curious with Machu Picchu is like, are there tracks? Are there like rope marks? I mean, because they had to drag these stones up into the mountains. How did they get the stones there? And that was one of the things that they didn't necessarily have an explanation for. They were like, well, you know, this quarry was X amount of feet below. We know where they cut them from. And then they got up there, but that there's no marks that allow us to know how they got the stones. So I asked him about it. And you said,
well, I think it makes a lot of sense just because we can't explain it doesn't rule out a possibility and using sound vibration. There's a little test now. It can be done on small objects. I absolutely believe that it was,
You tell me that you guys are able to move massive stones with like, what was it? Like, was it vibration or some form of like something?
No, not, I mean, I know there's guys who are able to move small objects right now with vibration. But there's a guy like in the Coral Gable Castle in Florida.
Yeah.
That was built in the early 20th century. It's newspaper documented.
Yeah.
One guy, small little Ukrainian guy, built the whole Coral Gable Castle. They had a huge tripod. At the tripod's a box. He wore a device around his neck.
Yep.
He worked by himself at night. And
he moved 20 and 30 ton stones by himself at night using vibration. It's incredible. And then he passed away without ever passing forward the technology. And if you go there, I never physically went, but we drove past it. And like, it was always one of those things when I lived in Florida, we were going
to
go.
Do you know, he had to move it at one point. I can't remember why. He had to move the site. And he moved it overnight on the truck. A truck came in empty. He started moving pieces. But yeah, he worked by himself.
Yeah.
For the most part. And so he was observed to have a device around his neck and then this massive tripod with these, you know, gears and mechanisms. And but the things he was able to do. So you're looking at it. These are, he did by himself.
Yeah. A little dude all by himself without ever, no help, nothing. Cut everything, figured out how to do it.
I can tell you that that's... that's not something I can do by myself right there. Looking at that, we could do that, but not by ourselves.
Yeah. Without, with cranes and huge, huge pieces of equipment.
So, yeah. So the technology's there. Just because we don't understand them didn't mean they exist. I think that's a lot of hubris in that thought. So I think there was levitation and that, that doesn't seem too far fetched for me, but, during one of these cataclysmic events, technologies were lost. And I think in the end, I just kind of absorb it. I'm like, I think it's fascinating. It's interesting. It's awesome to kind of dwell and just sink into that mystery. And
then, I think what's cool is it connects you to the past.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we really struggle with. I mean, earlier, I think it was last year, we had to do some genealogy for the kids for school. And so my daughter came home and she's like, here's this genealogy deal. Can you help me figure this out? And I sat down and got onto like all these different genealogy pages. And of course, like, she's like, I can only go back like one generation. And I was like, just leave it here, go to school. So after like 12 hours later, I basically mapped us back like 600 years, but there was a ton of information that had, we had been told by grandparents or other people that didn't match up, found all this other information that like opened up for my mom. Like talking to my mom, she's like, I didn't know half of the stuff that you told me. So I think it connects us to longer generations and it connects us to the past, which I think gives us historical precedence and gives us a vision that we're not just these solo free agents existing within time. We're part of a lineage that has existed for a ton of time. And I think that's what's fascinating on it is here is this. When you explained it to me, I like didn't necessarily even make a distinction between like mortar, dry stone. Like I just figured like stone. And now that I drive around here in Texas, I see a bunch of hand built stone walls.
Yeah.
Just driving that massive one. And so seeing it and then having a little bit of understanding of what you guys built with that little wall bench up there and realizing like, holy shit, man, first they had to find all these stones, then they had to arrange them in such a way. And now they're actually in some form of, deal where, 100, 200, 300 years from now, if something happens, you come back and you're going to see the stone wall and you're going to know that somebody intentionally put this here.
Well, yeah. I think what gets really fascinating about dry stone in particular. So I lived in, we can talk about how I got into it later, but I lived in Jerusalem after the Marine Corps for a year. And I used to walk down the old city every Shabbat. I kind of think that's where the seed was planted, but some of those limestone blocks are 2 tons up to 30 tons, massive, that was the Kotel, the Western Wall.
Which is the wall for the temple, right?
Yeah, it's basically a retaining wall. And then the temple mounts built up.
But the temple was destroyed. So that's like,
yeah, I'm saying now on the backside is where the Dome of the Rock is. And that's
So that's like they're, for those of you guys don't know, that's like when you see them praying, like touching the wall, that's their connection to like, is it the second temple or the first temple?
Yeah, second temple.
The second temple.
Yeah. I was a goy boy. So that means Gentile boy. So, but I was fascinated, fascinated with that place. I would just sit there, pictures of me just sitting there, and it's all the worn limestone. And so, but you think about this, as I always tell people, I've never met a human who doesn't love stone, and I don't meet humans who fly around to look at wood structures. What do people fly around to? They fly around to look at stone.
Unless it's a Taj Mahal. Isn't the Taj Mahal all wood?
No, it's all stone.
I thought the Taj Mahal was all wood.
No, it's stone.
The Taj Mahal is all stone.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a wood structure because they said there's no nail on the Taj Mahal. It was all lap joints and fitted together.
You want to confirm inside?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It was built
Look at Stonehenge.
Yeah.
I mean, like just a bunch of random stones, which is hilarious because people get all weird on it and they forget that those stones were laying down and some farmer brought out a crane and just reassembled them when he thought it looked like.
It got reassembled. But, you know, people fly around to look at stone. So stone has, I think it's a reason why I think people are so fascinated with stone is that I think maybe on a cellular level or something, I'm not going to get artificially deep with it, that we know we wouldn't exist without the rock mantle, the rock crust underneath us. So then all of a sudden Mother Earth creates, igneous stone is basalt and granite. So that's lava stone that comes up. It's molten lava that comes up and cools. Then you have sedimentary, and that's your limestone and sandstone. And then you have metamorphic, and that's like any of those igneous and sedimentary that go through more heat and more pressure, and it becomes like limestone eventually can become marble. Sandstone can become quartzite. Mm-hmm. So that's metamorphic. All of a sudden, you have all this abundant material in these gorgeous colors, and we get to build with that for legacy, to create legacy or to create function. And I think that's what's really fascinating about all this. And, you know, what's interesting, though, is getting a lot of young guys on Instagram reach out. I'm finding a lot of guys, you know, 20s, early 20s, late 20s. They want to explore, get into this field because there's something so real about it for them. There's something they want. I mean, I've had young guys actually say, I want to do something meaningful with purpose with my hands and physical. And then that's the interesting part about dry stone versus wet traditional work is dry stone can be very physical. And it's one of my physical trades. You know, two of my projects before that big one in Truckee in 2016 through 2017, we had no machine access. So everything was, that's where we were doing, you know, dollying 200 pound cornerstones 100 yards through the woods. You know, that's where we're...
What was the project?
The first one with no machine access was the Colorado Portal Project. That's the Moon Gate. Mm-hmm. I call them portals. And so, you know, we were doing just old techniques, you know, putting 2x4s and pipes and moving stones like that. And then cribbing, that's where you do the kind of seesaw method with wood. Mm-hmm. And then so it's all... And I have these videos on YouTube and stuff where we fast forwarded it to music. And then the second one, which was the Kiva, and that's also in Durango, Colorado. We didn't have any machine access. So that was just chisels and hammers and dollies. So it's very physical. So, you know, there's a lot of interest in the physicality of this trade, as well as that the end result of your physical efforts can be something beautiful, you know? So
well, there's also an eternal piece, the idea that stands the test of time. That, you know, I mean, if you were going to try to imprint information to hand down through the generations, the best way to do it is through stone and through some form of stone structure. Like I remember, I think it was Graham Hancock that talked about the dimensions of the Great Pyramid at Giza. If you times that by like 42,500, effectively gives you the circumference and all the different dimensions of the earth. You know, and if you were going to try to find a way to capture that information and hold it for eternity, what's the best way to do it? Create the most stable structure on the planet that'll never, I mean, you know, the age old joke is the only thing that time's afraid of are the pyramids.
Yeah. So mathematics.
Well, the Taj Mahal is made of marble.
Yeah.
And they killed all the people that designed it, created it, and all the craftsmen had
their hands cut off.
So they couldn't create again. Yeah. So
thanks, Jamie.
I thought it was, okay, so it's made of marble. Interesting. Yeah.
Marble is a metamorphic stone from limestone. So that just means it's gone through more earth pressure and heat. And then, you know, what's fascinating, a lot of people listening, limestone is calcium carbonate, seashells.
Whoa, lots of limestone here in the hill country.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you think about in Indiana, where I grew up in southern Indiana, you have 200-300 foot limestone quarries. That means at some point that was a sea. So the 10,000 year creation thing doesn't really jive there.
Well, I heard a pretty good one that somebody was like, you know, prove to me that the earth isn't 6,000 years old. And the guy's like, lead. And go through like the different like metamorphosis that has to happen for lead to exist, puts us at like, you know, 6 billion years. Like, hey, lead starts as this, and this. So the fact that we have lead pencils, if I can choose your thing, and I'm going to do a terrible job of going through the evolution of it, but it was, you know, I mean, it, like, you know, the idea that I always loved, you know, people being like, oh, fossils were put there to trick us,
yeah.
And I'm like,
test our faith.
That's a lot. There's a lot of fossils.
Yeah. So, you know, that's, and then you think about Texas, we're sitting on, we are a limestone bedrock, and it goes under the Gulf all the way to the Yucatan Peninsula. And that's all limestone as well. You ever been out to Tulum?
Mm-hmm.
You've been to Tulum? Oh my God. You gotta go. But that's, it's just like hill country with jungle.
Yeah.
Or not hill country. It's more like, you know, it's more like a dripping springs with the jungle.
Yeah. I mean, what's wild is they have these, what's called cenotes, which are these, like the, because the ground is all, I mean, it's limestone.
Yeah,
it's all rock. Yeah. So nothing really exists. And so what happens is when it rains, all the water collects in these underground caverns that are called cenotes. And the Mayans believe that that cenote was the connection to the underworld. But I mean, it was cool. We went to Tulum, we got to go visit, and you jump off and you see them. And, you know, if you click on Instagram, like every influencer in the world, like their Mecca is like Tulum. So they can like take pictures with like.
Oh, is this the place with the jungle weight room? Yeah.
This is the Tulum jungle weight room. And then everywhere you go, there's some like piece of art that you can take pictures of for your Instagram page. And then
I worked out at that gym. At that jungle.
Yeah, we went by it. It's fun. I was trying to get Kate to go in, and she had wanted no part of it.
Yeah, it was a little too Flintstone-ish, and you know, there were Instagram influencers from Russia. These guys out there, and they go pump up, and they go on the beach and film, and it just makes the whole process kind of look.
When as we were in Tulum, it just looked so fucking just like everywhere you go, somebody's posing for something, you know. It'd be great for Instagrammers in the wild.
But the food is out of this world.
Food was good. They just had the cartel wasn't real big there, but now they are because they're dealing a lot of drugs. And so now they have a bunch of shootings, and Tulum's not nearly as safe as it used to be.
So it's a good time for you to go.
Probably not.
So when I was a kid, we went to Mexico City. So one of my dad's, my dad was a lawyer. One of the guys he worked with a ton was a lawyer in Mexico and also a senator. So we got to go to Mexico City for his wedding. And we got to go to the huge pyramids in Mexico City. I think it was the Sun and the Moon Pyramid. And what was wild is back then you could actually climb to the top where they have an altar where they, you know, sacrifice like 30,000 people in a day. And so my brothers and I somewhere have pictures of us like basically reenacting this, of course, because we're laying there trying to pretend we can stand each other. We raced up and down. And then we ended up going to Chichen Itza, which was pretty amazing.
In Tulum.
Or it's outside Tulum.
Yeah.
But just like... You're talking about stone structures.
Well, I went there too, but I have a critique of Chichen Itza. So when I went there, this is 2000.
Did you go for the big rave? They have a huge rave there.
No, that's it felt dark to me, man. Like
there's a lot of evil.
Yeah. Because
there's a lot of death.
It was you know, the Mayan culture was, you know, they lived around fear. Fear that if there wasn't enough, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but basically the sun, you know, the sun's existence in time and the cycles were based off, you know, how much, you know, I guess at some point someone decided it was blood. It was sacrifices is what fed this cycle. Yeah. It's probably not the best way to explain it, but that's essentially, so it's a fear base. And so Chichen Itza and all the structures around there, when I was there, because I'm pretty intuitive and emotive dude, it just felt dark.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, and while the structures are fantastic in terms of their execution, their astronomical lining, the aesthetics of them. I mean, you know, I looked at their bond pattern. Bond pattern is how a stone's laid in conjunction with another stone above or underneath it. Their bond pattern's off. It has running joints. Running joints is a big no-no. And I always thought. And also, they didn't have allegedly they didn't have any wheeled structures at the time. So I could see. I was looking at all the pieces, thinking. I probably saw pieces no bigger than what three men could move. Everything was 1 to 2 man stones with some sort of probably basket or something like that. But while the, you know, the mathematics, the alignment, all that was fantastic, it was both dark to me, and also the pavers, that's the outside facade, weren't done well. And I always think that you can see structures built historically that were done during good times for beauty, for the possibility of. And then if you walk, if you climb up the big one there at Chichen Itza, which we did, the rise run ratio, super steep.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty freaky.
Yeah, no.
Did you go up the top?
Yeah.
It has to be.
Be so that they were literally throwing bodies off. It's the only way. Yeah, they would roll. Like so the only thing, like in all the pyramids we climbed in Mexico, the only thing that was amazing was as we were climbing down or even climbing up, like trying to pick a line where nobody was behind you. So as we were coming down, there was a whole bunch of people. We like picked a different line because...
Fallers.
Yeah. Well, fallers, but they... and if somebody falls, they don't stop because so what they were doing, and I think I can't remember if it was Chichen Itza or which one, but allegedly goes that they sacrificed 30,000 people so that they could bathe the entire
ever or at
in
once
one day, in one day so that they could bathe the entire structure in blood. So they started slitting throats and just murdering. And like allegedly the way it goes,
it's bold strategy, Cotton.
So, but the way that the steps are laid out is if you toss a body, and I know this because as we were coming down, there was a fat tourist that was wearing flip-flops and the lady slipped and dude, she started going and was picking up speed. And thank God somebody like fucking stopped her. But I remember thinking
sliding or rolling.
She started sliding and then she like fell on this. And then like, you know, some people like stopped her, but it was interesting how quickly and I remember my daughter was like, why are these steps so steep? I'm like, so you can throw people from the top to get to the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, even I went down like on all fours.
Yeah, like you kind of slide steep. Down. Yeah, and
so you think that that's what...
They're steep and they're really narrow. So yeah. Like, it's... I'm with you on that.
It just felt dark to me.
That was what was part of like the idea with the pyramids was like, oh, slaves built this. And like, slaves didn't build this. There's no way that anything that's built with this much, like you can't put a whip to somebody's back to build this.
Well, even if it was, it was still built with the intention of something glorious, you know, something, you know, that's a different intention, you know, just, and then in Peru, the same thing was built, you know, I totally believe because of the high seismic activity in Peru, the interlocking joinery, it's unique in the world, is built for the earthquake activity there. But it was still built as, you know, it was potential. It was also beautiful. So I think you kind of get that feel. And, you know, and that's where we're at now.
Well, but I mean, if you really look at that Mayan culture is extended. I mean, if you look at the cartels and all that stuff are all based on death cults.
Yep.
So they worship, you know, like, what is it? What is it like basically the mother of death? It's like Dies de las Muertas, but like they're all death cults. So they use a lot of imagery of like skulls and death and it extends from the Mayans because, you know, I mean, that's their culture. So what's hilarious, and I know this because my brother, who's a lawyer, had some cases with some of this stuff. And so we went through all the case stuff just for the imagery and I'm fascinated by it, but it's like, this is the foundation of their culture. This is how they've extended this idea of killing and sacrifices, this has been part of their culture since the beginning. So the fact that we're surprised by it is more interesting than not.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, scary dudes.
Pretty wild.
Yeah.
Well, let's take us back, John. Former Marine, and movement as training has always been a part of your life. And then our conversations out up top when you were building with Callan was based around just your value of movement, beauty, and essentially all you have to do on the job is lift heavy, awkward things through all planes of motion that could potentially hurt you.
Yeah. So I'll draw that line from when I was 14 to now. It's an interesting one. So when I was 14, it was right after the 1983 Beirut bombings in Lebanon, the Marine barracks, 283 guys died. For some reason, I mean, I was, you know, I grew up the son of a Baptist preacher. We had no TV, nothing. I mean, I don't know. I saw it in the newspaper. For some reason, that I told my mom at piano lessons, like, I'm going to the Marine Corps. Never changed my mind. So I started training, and I started doing pull-ups on a tree. 22 years ago, I went back. That tree, the bark was still smooth. You know, because I did so many pull-ups. So when I was 14, I started my own training program. And I just did it based off what their fitness tests were, et cetera. So I did that from 14 to 19, you know, and I mean, it didn't matter, winter, whatever, I was concentrated. And it's funny because right before I went in the Marine Corps, I thought 2 miles, oh my God, 3 miles. I couldn't even imagine, it was so hard, but I ended up getting like the, you know, PFT or the platoon series in the Marine Corps. But what was really cool was when I got in the Marines, I developed a yes policy for myself, meaning say yes to any opportunity. And so I got this in boot camp, I got this opportunity I signed up to be infantry because I wanted to go in the reconnaissance. But I got this opportunity to go to language school and switch out to the signals intelligence field. So following my own advice, I said yes, and I ended up joining this radio reconnaissance team. And we worked with Force Recon, so we had to do a lot of the same schools, you know, and had the same capacities as them. We just weren't door kickers. We were on the tactical SIGINT side. So once I got through that selection with these guys, we are a 6-man team attached to a Force Recon platoon. And that's like, for people out there, the old Force Reconnaissance of the Marine Corps was like the Navy SEAL of that time. And so that's a big deal because that's all I ever wanted to do. I mean, when I was 16, I laid out my life. My life plan was a career in the military and eventually to switch to the Army. And then I wanted to get into Delta ever since I was 16 years old. That was I had everything laid out. Marine Corps first. A lot of guys in the SF community and in the Army back in the 80s and 90s would go in the Marine Corps first, and then you switch out and you can kind of like do a pipeline into...
Delta recruits from all branches of services.
Yeah, back then I don't think they did. But once you leave the Marine Corps, you can go to any branch of the mm-hmm. service without going back. See, when I was in boot camp, I had a former Air Force staff sergeant who had to start back over and go to boot camp. Marine Corps just doesn't allow that. So anyways, I developed this yes policy. So I said yes to everything. All of a sudden, what was cool about the Marine Corps, at least when I was in and my unit, is there's like basically like a chalkboard. It's almost like a dry eraser board. They would just write up a school. Just who wants to go to survival school, Greenberry Survival School? Who wants to go to combat swimmer school? I said yes to everything I could. And in that short period of time, like when I went to boot camp, I was 145 pounds. A year and a half later, I was 180. I was jacked too. I have pictures of me. I just posted them on Instagram. I post that because I'm seeing more and more young guys who just completely lack not just strength. They lack muscularity. And I'm like, you know, I'm 53 now, man. I should not be just... You know, you're 22 at your prime. You know, when I went and that was 18 months, I put on 35 pounds. And that was my potential. I never could exceed that. I did that with Arnold Schwarzenegger's Encyclopedia of Bodybuilding.
Yeah.
It's huge. Do you remember that thing?
Yeah. Oh, we still got it.
Yeah, we still got it.
So
it's in that orange box right out there. I mean, Tex looks at it at least twice a day.
So that was my... That was
fire.
That was my thing. And that's all I did. So, you know, on the physicality route, what I explored, what was so cool is in the Marine Corps, gave me ample opportunity to push the limits and the boundaries. I went to amphibious reconnaissance school. I learned how to swim, you know, swim at night, swim out in the ocean, swim with packs, 20-mile runs, 10 miles with sandbag runs, stuff like that. And then I pushed myself in the gym. You know, I just wanted to get big because you're 19, 20 years old, and all of a sudden you're in this environment that just says, just, you know, that's all you do. Like, that's, you know, you eat, you train, and you work out. So it's this beautiful environment for a young guy with a lot of ambition to just explore the physicality. And especially when units like Force Recon and our Radio Reconnaissance unit, that was expected. You know, I remember watching these guys, like, they're probably 10-year NCOs in Force Recon running barefoot and just silkies. So I tried that. They would just run barefoot along the side of the road. I'm like, that's cool. I'm going to do barefoot. It kind of hurt, but just watching these guys, you know, constantly. And so that environment, it really habituated in me how important that was. But I also, one thing I did really smart when I was 19, I did, I called it flexibility training back then. I did 2 to 3 hours a week. Never had any major injuries ever. And I realized range of motion, mobility, all that was super important along with what everything else I was doing. So I did 4 years of that, went to all these great schools, all this training. And also, you know, by the end of that, I could do 20 miles or 325, 400 pound deadlifts, plus swim in the ocean a mile. These were all norms at that point. These were like benchmarks. Now it's like, okay, what can I do beyond that? So, you know, that continued. I never stopped, never have stopped ever. You know, and then, I'll talk about what happened in my 20s as far as the transition with the Army, but I want to get to kind of now, because I think it's real important, is what I saw I ended up not doing a career for a lot of reasons. And when I got into my 30s and I started landscaping, and then I got into stone heavy work, and that was in 2007, I met these two masons. And these guys, one was an old buddy from high school, and another was this guy in Seattle, and they both had big crews. And I said, you know, I asked them, because, you know, a lot of masons don't ever want to get out of the field. They love being hands-on. And I remember Tom telling me, you know, he had a back injury because he tried to catch a stone rolling down the back of a dump truck as it was up. And the other guy just got so big that he had to go to become an office guy, right? What I learned from these guys was, if you love that work, not to grow too much, but two, the physicality. A lot of these guys, what I realized, a lot of these guys were never off. They're always on, either, you know, doing the stonework, or they never did anything in their downtime. And then you go out cold, mm-hmm. and you go out to lift. Sometimes, you know, you can lift a 220 stone just a little bit to get, so someone can get a wedge under it. Boom, they're done. So I applied all that stuff that I learned in my 20s, you know, as far as smart training as I could with flexibility training every time I had any downtime. And then what happened, where I think the big switch for me was in 2013, I went to outdoor training only. That was all, what I called it was C2 training. I still call it C2, competency and capacity. So I made that up because it was kind of like my purpose for why I work out. It went from, you know, 20-year-old ego stuff being built to, I was 38, 39, 40 when I really started getting into the dry stone. It's like, you know, I want competency and capacity. But that wasn't just for stone. See, I was in Bosnia teaching English. I was 30 years old. And this is another kind of like benchmark moment. And I flew out of the country, came back in. It's January in Banja Luka, Republika Srpska, freaking cold, probably 0 degrees. I got in late. I was supposed to stay at this NGO lady, this American's house, right? She said, hey, I'll leave the front door open. So I spoke Serbian, but the taxi guy dropped me off, and it was a new neighborhood, literally like January, 0 degrees. She wasn't there. She locked the doors. And I was like, fuck, man. And so I could see lights on in their second story, because a lot of them had 2 to 3 story kind of like block and brick houses, but they had steel, concrete balconies with steel trellises. So they have flat top garages. So what I did is I needed to get in the back, but I couldn't get in the back without going over the garage. So I jumped up, did a dead hang, you know, pull up, whatever you call this one.
Muscle up
over the garage in the dark, dragged my bag, went, dropped it on the backside. No visibility. It was a cloudy night. I could hear like, boom, it's only about 10 feet. Dropped, kind of did a parachute landing fall. And then they had steel gutters that were fastened to the wall. So I shimmied up the steel gutter, grabbed that first balcony, like that, dead hang, went up the trellis, flopped over, and her door was open. And I'm like, not a big deal in terms, it wasn't life or death, but what it showed me was like, I don't know what I would have done that night, because I had no resources, I had no money, I didn't know anybody in the neighborhood. If I couldn't have done that, I'm not sure what I would have done. So that kind of carried through. And so that's my kind of capacity and competency thing, because I'd also, at that time, so by 40, I had 4 kids. And, you know, and I remember I'd seen a story about a guy online who went out to the water to save his two kids, but died because he couldn't swim. But he did the right thing. He took the right action.
Did the kids live?
I don't know.
Oh my God.
I remember a couple of these where the man took right action, but didn't either have the physicality or either overweight, you know, or couldn't swim or couldn't bring him in. And so I started thinking about, I need to maintain, I want that, but also for my work. So that's when I kind of developed this C2 thing. And then everything after that went outdoors. And then that's when I started doing log work, tire work. I just figured it out on my own. But then I started doing just weird things like picking stones up from behind me. I didn't know anything about transverse plane or anything. Mm-hmm. I just started thinking of, what do I do at a job site? I'll do that a little more extreme so that when I go to the job site, I'm habituated to a proper motion. Like, you know, I always have this thing I look up before I lift just to put my cervical back into the proper, you know, I don't know if that's correct, but that's what I do. I lift, I look up, and then I pick a stone up. And then we always tell the guys is, you know, I see them bend over, I say stop, and then I'd have them do 3 to 5 rounds like that, and I tap their back like that. So now I've got a gym, outdoor gym in Lockhart. Got a lot smarter. Started watching this dude, Sergeant Mack, on Instagram. He is a former Delta Force guy that I actually met in language school a long time ago. He does a lot of this transverse plane stuff. So I started doing all this stuff where putting like a line at waist height, pick up a stone going under mm-hmm. and up around it. You know, I have a tire and I'll hold this stone, dead arm it, because I had to learn to do that because I used to have a really bad habit of holding stones up here, and it was my, what do you call these?
Cervical.
Scalenes.
Yeah, your scalenes.
Oh man, they were so tight that I was having all this nerve dysfunction from all this. So I dead arm it, and what I do is I walk in and out of this tire constantly, in and out of the tire constantly, or sometimes I'll lift a stone up. And I've had to do pretty much everything I've trained, I've had to do on a job site. On the last one we did in Austin was up on top of a house. We did all this stone work up on top of a building. There's this three-dimensional stone art roof deck. And I'm up there laughing one day how everything I train I've had to do up there because we had a literal obstacle course to get stone around. I'm walking backwards, holding a stone that's, you know, it's probably a 3,000-pound or 3,000-piece dollar value stone. And I have to walk backwards and I make sure we don't drop it. So that's kind of like my training now is just capacity competency. Mm-hmm. And it's how I apply it at the job site so that I'm not, when I get sloppy, it's kind of good sloppy. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're actually doing the training that is allowing you to execute your task. You know, something we've talked about at Power Athlete since day one is the training allowing you to fulfill your task and your purpose? You know, a lot of times, you know, you'll see training stuff. And I think for better or worse, social media has really given people a better understanding. But, you know, as a football player, if the training didn't allow me to flourish as a football player, then, you know, it just didn't make the cut. And a lot of times within the training deal, if you don't have some physical test for your training, how do you know whether or not you're hitting the mark? Just looking at, you know, do I physically look better? I mean, like, it's so hard to see changes over the course of a day within the mirror. I mean, but to physically say, hey, I did this and I can do this, opposed from somebody couldn't do this and I can do this. Now that becomes a greater representation of that. And are you healthy? Are you able to move? Are you dynamic? I mean, all these things come into play. And are you avoiding injury? You know, I mean, to be 53, I keep thinking as you're talking about it, Rudy Reyes has got to be about the same age. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you ever ran into Rudy about that time.
No, I've seen him.
The legend of Rudy Reyes.
I think he was Pendleton. I was Camp Lejeune, second Marine Division. So he was out. Pretty sure he was
California guy.
Yeah, California. Because the Marine Corps has three. He's got first division, California, second North Carolina, and third is Okinawa. And you're kind of, I mean, when you're just doing 4 years, you're basically at that point.
Yeah.
But no, he was definitely in when I was in. Yeah. He was in I think Battalion Recon. Yeah. So he, and then he's, you know. And what does he do now?
Rudy's on a TV show. It's called, is it like the UK Selection?
SOS.
SOS. So what they do is, it's over in the UK.
SAS?
British SAS. Yeah. Well, so what they do is they find people that are emotionally broken. And
That's the first line to describe them.
Yeah. They take people that are emotionally broken, I think, and then they put them into this selection pipeline. Yeah. Just everywhere. And they put them into selection process. And I think they have, who is it? Jason Fox, Rudy, and then a few others. And then they have these individuals as kind of your DI, I don't know, we call them like a running selection almost. And then I think like the person that makes it to the very end through all these challenges, it's kind of a Biggest Loser, Survivor meets America's Got Talent kind of a thing. But it's a huge show in the UK. And the way we know it's a huge show in the UK is Harry Heppenstall, who's one of the legs of the tripod for Power Athlete, is based out of the UK in Manchester, and is like, Rudy's on every tabloid, on every bus. Like, that's funny. Is a huge, huge star in the UK because he's so not English.
I know. Yeah, yeah.
And the tabloids.
Rudy's just, Rudy.
Yeah. I mean, Rudy Reyes is like, there is no pretending to be Rudy Reyes. Yeah.
So much so in the show, the Generation Kill, about his unit, he played himself because they couldn't find an actor to represent him.
Well, they brought on him as a,
consultant.
Yeah, as a consultant. Yeah. And then finally they were like, you're just going to have to pay you because we can't find anybody.
Yeah, there were cats like that in the Marine Corps. I remember in Force Recon team, 7th Platoon, there was these two dudes, Mo and Dog. And Mo and Dog had zero respect for anybody. They didn't give a fuck. And I remember they both shaved their head, but they left a tuft here. A little tuft, just to say, fuck it. And they Mo and Dog, man, you go in, and you can't make these guys up. And there's, I love those guys. I mean, that's what's so wild about the military. Like,
I've always said so we were very fortunate to do a lot of work with the military, and it's a big black hole that they throw money into. And I mean, it's super confusing. I mean, like the fact that it employs people and the contracting piece. I've always said if you were going to really streamline this thing, you just make it a whole bunch of Marines.
Oh, well, I mean, if we're testing for fitness,
Marines
can pull up.
Well, that's why it's tough to be, it's hard to have a fat ass and do pull-ups. So that's one thing we always loved about the Marines is they always had pull-ups, which means they couldn't have fat asses. And the best thing that I love about Marines is even when you meet old Marines, they still tell you that they're a Marine.
Yeah.
Like you'll meet like a 60-year-old dude and he'll introduce himself as a Marine and you're like, I can fucking see it. You got the same haircut. They still are pretty fit. Like they identify like that Marine thing is like indoctrinated into their entire life.
It's interesting. So one of the other things, start watching out for this when you're driving. Most Marine veterans will just put the decal. It's the Eagle Globe and Anchor on their left side driver's back door. Most of them. I have it on all our vehicles. Even my daughter, I call it. It's her get out of speeding ticket.
Why the left side?
I don't know. I think it's because that's where the driver is. It's on the back left side. Most of them. What you'll see with Army and Veteran and Air Force, especially Army guys, is they've got stickers and bumper stickers. They got their story everywhere. But most, I would say, I've looked at this for years. I'd say 85% of veterans, if they're Marine, will just have that one simple sticker. But you look at everything else and they got a storyline. So I went, this is a good, something you guys are talking about, the pull up and all this stuff. So, I got out of the Marine Corps. 92, went to Israel to study because I was trying to get into Egypt at the American University in Cairo to study Arabic because I wanted to go back into, I planned to go back in the Army, go in the 5th group. That was the Middle Eastern, there's a geography.
We worked with plenty of guys in 5th group.
So I want to go 5th group, do my time, then try out for Delta. I made this plan when I was 16, 17. So, but I couldn't get in. I ended up getting offer to go study in Israel. So I did. I'm like, I'll go study in Jerusalem and do Arabic. Well, they made me do Hebrew. I'm like, I can't do two Semitic languages. That's too hard. So I did Hebrew for the year. Fantastic experience in Israel. I worked there locally at a gym, the biggest gym in, because I got my fitness trainer thing. that was awesome year. And I got out, went back, met Mark Burnett. This is before he got famous, and went with him to, he had a bunch of SEAL guys, went into this raid Goulois in Madagascar, came back, did the Eco Challenge, the first 300-mile adventure race in Utah. So I put a team together for that. what I was trying to do is get back in the Army, but it was just some reason in the 90s, it was a slowdown. It was just hard to get in.
Well, there's no war.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess they had the bombing of the barracks, and there was Beirut.
It was the cutbacks and stuff like that. So I finally got in 96. I got back in to the Army as a former Marine. And man, you talk about it. It was, they put me in the 82nd because I was a parachutist in the Marine Corps. And it was hell. Oh my God. Such a different culture. Such a different culture.
Yeah.
You know, at lunchtime, you know, the pull-up bars were out front of the barracks, and I wore my silkies because that's what we were famous for, silkies. I still wear them. Do my pull-ups and go. I would go around Delta's compound, do the 10-mile run, come back, do pull-ups, and everybody's gaming or something like that. And they just, what I found the two different cultures, you know, you may have kind of seen this. Other than, you know, Ranger units and the SF units, I was around a lot of those guys. I always felt like the Army had they had a corporate mentality. And they also didn't trust their own training. And the Marine Corps, you know, Marine Corps has, you know, they just, you had E3s, which are Lance Corporal. That was just the, you were just the average, you're just a.
Yeah, but different. Every man's a rifleman.
Yeah.
Which allows, I mean, everybody's a trigger puller. Even if you're a, you know, a secretary or this or whatever, like you have to be able to pass the PT and you're a trigger puller. You were there as a rifleman. So.
But they also trusted. They trusted in you to execute. I mean, we did. And when I went into the Army, I mean, they had E6s, staff sergeants, doing what Marine Corps 10th 3 E3s doing. So I found a really, I found just the fact that I was PTing at lunch created a lot of antagonism in the unit I was in.
For working too hard. Mm-hmm. You're making us look bad, right?
We ran into that all the time. It was something we did a ton of stuff at Fort Bragg and worked a ton with the Army, and there was definitely a pervading thing of like, don't make us look bad, you know. It was different, man. Like you know, we come from a, you know, culture where it's, you know, go 100 miles an hour and those are the people we want to work with, and it just, you know, I mean, but when you get into something that's that big of a logistical deal with that many MOSs and that deal, I mean, it looks more like a corporation.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're going to go fight wars, just go get a bunch of 18-year-old Marines who love to get Marines tattoos. Like, I've never seen anybody with like an Army of One or like, you know, like I've never really seen. I mean, like, I can spot Marines just because of the terrible tribals or the tattoos, you know, and you're like,
God, bad tattoo clubs.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I'll see tribals like George Bryant. We went on that ride with Matt Vincent for Indian. George is a like marketing guru. All of a sudden he like strips down and he's got tribal. And I'm like, George, I didn't know you were a Marine. And he's like, oh yeah. You know? And it's like, he's like, they make us in a factory. This is who we are.
Yeah.
And
something about it. I mean, it doesn't matter what kind of life, you know, evolution you have after that. There's
kinship. Like if you meet other Marines, like it's hilarious. Yeah. Like two Marines meet on the street and they're like hugging. And next thing you know, like they might've never served together. They might never know, but like they share that bond.
Yeah, there's something there and it has to do, it happens in boot camp. I still haven't been able to figure it out, but it's there. It's unique. I think it still exists. You know, what's interesting is how far the Marine Corps evolved after, you know, in the 2000s with all their combat fitness test and then their martial arts program. Oh my God, we didn't have that at all.
I did want to get to it. Maybe this is the wrong time, but your emphasis on team on your projects. Mm. And that was something we had the opportunity to be a part of at Callan's deal. And did that originate in the Marines or was it something you found when you met the two Masons?
No. What's a good way to describe that? So, 2016, I invited the first apprentice to work with me. I brought him on the project in 2017. So I had this big project in Truckee. We had, it was two seasons. It was a $4 million budget in the end. And, it, you know, I had our crew, plus I had three apprentices, plus I was managing all these other craftsmen, sculptors, blacksmiths, lighting guys. These guys were all friends of mine I'd met in different states. So they're all what I call fellow craftsmen. What I did on the project for that one and the two preceding, what I started thinking about is how do I execute? I don't want to micromanage because I'm on site building too. So how do I execute in a way where I'm bringing out a guy's innate desire to detail, because the details matter. The details, I always say details matter greatly. How do you get that out of people? And I really started thinking about that. So I came up with a couple of things. One is, how did the Marine Corps do it? So I just kind of went back. I even called my buddy who was a 20-year Marine. He got out as Lieutenant Colonel. No, Major. And I asked him. I said, kind of reviewed with him. And what I figured out was this, and it worked brilliantly because I did it at the big project, is I did three things. I started off by every guy that came onto the project, I did I call it scheme enhancement. So you go to a typical project, like with contractors, and they just start pointing to the subs or to the laborers, just do this, you know, do this, do that. What's the meaning? What's the purpose? They don't know. They're just nailing something in over there. I'm like, that's not good enough. So what I would do is I bring every guy in, even the other trades, the lighting guy, the blacksmiths, and I'd go over the whole project. We'd walk the site with them. I'd show them the plans, but I also showed them, I communicated to them what the purpose of this project was. Like we had a thematic purpose. Like what, mm-hmm. you know, we have a meaning for this project. So I told them that. We walked it, I showed them the plans, and then I sketched out stuff like that. So what they did is by the end of that hour, they were engaged in the full picture of the project and what it was. So when they had something to do, whether it was the owner who's going to build the sculptures or it was one of my apprentices who I just needed to do these tasks over here, they knew it was part of something greater. So then step two, for like my apprentices and my guys, because everything we did on the projects was first time ever. It was a technique I created called modern stonecraft. So we ended up having 360 tons of stone. It was all pre-cut. We set everything with vacuum lifters and machines. It was like big, huge Legos, right? No one's ever done that before. But we also had a timeline. We had 6 months. And I had all these details are really important. So what I did was something I learned in Marine Corps was I communicate to them what the objective was. We call it terminal learning objective, whatever. I said, here's what I want done. Here's the tools. You know, here's a grinder. Here's a special saw. Here's this chisel. I would say, and here's the detail I want. But I said, you know, and I would tell them, like, this detail matters greatly. Here's why. And then I'd make sure they understood it. They understood how to do a thing. What I learned to do was what I learned in Marine Corps. I walked away. I didn't sit there and, you know, I walked away. I literally would leave, go to the other side of the project, or go in town. And then I energetically, I let these guys go at it. Here's a little trick I learned from, you guys ever heard Dan Doyle? Dan Coyle.
Yeah, the Talent Code.
And then who are the guys that wrote about flow? Jamie Whelan, those guys?
Oh, the flow state.
Had Steve Kotler.
Steve Kotler.
Okay, so between Jamie Whelan, Steve Kotler, Dan Coyle, because I was always reading all these books, because I always like, how do you get people to buy my vision? These projects were my vision. I mean, they're literally my creation, my design. How do I get people to get to that level? Well, they had to have a sense of purpose and meaning. Mm-hmm. And they also had to be engaged. I'm like, well, how do I engage them? So this is like step three is I gave them all the tools, gave them purpose, gave them the task. But I walk away and I said, we have this is a one-off. I said, you're the guy. And what I learned from these books is that if you set the bar higher than what they think they're capable of, and then you put some restriction on it, I mean, we got 2 hours of time, or we're one man short today, but we got to get this done, people go into flow state more. And I've experimented this over and over. I actually think it's true. So it's just the combination of I'm putting this bar higher, and see, in the Army, they always lower the bar. Mm-hmm. The Marine Corps, they raise the bar, and they say, meet that. We trained you. We expect that. And we're going to go away and we come back, da da da. So I watch these guys who've never done any of this stuff before. I come back and they're just killing this detail that's on my website. Like it's something that some architects think it's the greatest detail. This is a brand new guy. I didn't do it. I just taught him. So, and then the other thing I did, you kind of saw this at the photo or the video shoot, was food. Food is a big deal. Man, at that project, I had my buddy who's a canvas designer make a big wall tent, and then I built it on a deck. We had a coffee machine, we had a table, we had fans, and every day we had mandatory lunches, but I spent money on food. I didn't hold back, man.
The thing I was amazed on is I imagined we have a seat. I kind of pictured like a much bigger wall, so I was amazed at how long it takes. I thought that I was like...
Well, they wanted to build a wall, but Callan was fucking lollygagging.
He was...
he set one stone.
Well, the word I like to use is titty ball jackoff. So I used to play, I had a high school football coach that used to yell at us for playing titty ball jackoff, and nobody knew what the fuck he was talking about. So to this day, and I use it with DJ and these guys, they're like, I still don't know what titty ball jackoff until I saw what Brian Callan did, which was nothing, which is titty ball jackoff. He just was fucking around, you know, making it look like he was doing something while these guys were working. So, and had a hell of a time and a great sense of humor. So I can't be mad at him about that, but
glue guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, just even that, you know, but that's like the food. So what I found is that's the final bonding thing is. So I took these guys, everybody that came, we had literally no budget for food, meaning no budget limit. Food was, I mean, we went out to pubs or, you know,
if you feed your people, if you feel like I told this recently when I was first went to the Philadelphia Eagles, we were in Veterans Stadium. It was fucking awful food. Like it was like something similar to like maybe what you'd get at the game. There'd be like hot dogs and shit.
Ugh.
It was fucking terrible. So we never ate there. And so guys would like either I packed a lunch or we had to go get sandwiches for the old guys. And then Andy Reid, who likes to eat, when we moved in the new facility, you know, built this bitch in kitchen and brought in a high end chef. I mean, to the point where I met the dude and he's like, anything you want, just bring it in the morning and I'll make sure you leave with it. So I would bring him like a turkey prime rib. I'd just bring him stuff and the dude would cook it. And so I didn't realize at the time how important the quality of food is, that it's a way of almost appreciation.
Yeah.
Like you cook somebody a nice meal, like you work hard, like it's a way of showing appreciation for me personally. I don't know how other people view it. You know, it's like you go over to somebody's house for dinner and they put on an amazing spread. You go over to my brother's house and he does boiled chicken and you're like, fuck you, I'm not eating this. So there's like an interesting...
Boiled chicken?
Oh yeah, my older brother was not my middle brother Ed. My oldest brother Rob was like the king of like, oh yeah, we're having boiled chicken and some and you know, come over for dinner and fucking give you boiled chicken and broccoli. I'd be like, oh, you're an asshole. I'm just not gonna eat. But then when I went to the Chiefs, all of a sudden, same deal. Super cheap owners looking at the bottom line, and the food was fucking awful. It was cold cuts, and I was back to what we were. And I was like, and I used to tell people, I'm like, I know the reason we don't win games. I know why. This team is never going to win. It's because of the way they treat us with the food. And people didn't believe me. Sure enough, Andy Reid goes there. They build a new facility, put in a bitchin' kitchen, and they win a Super Bowl. And I'm telling you.
At the Chiefs.
So that's I played for Andy at the Eagles, and I went to the Chiefs with Dick Vermeil. And then Andy obviously went to the Chiefs. You know, they got Mahomes, and they put actually, you know, our owner passed away and his son took over, who, you know, wasn't nearly just, hey, like we got money, let's fucking win and open the checkbook. Next thing you know.
That's interesting because there's something called new owner syndrome. And most people that get their hands on a professional team try to make a big trade or bring in a big guy. Well, but it sounds like a better move is to upgrade your facilities.
Well, so, I'm totally dropping the name on,
Hunt.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. So Mr. Hunt, who was, you know, I mean, the Hunt Trophy for the AFC. I mean, he was a very nice man, but it was very bare bones in a lot of ways. He passes away, and Clark Hunt, who is his son, takes over, who, you know, basically has always been very wealthy. And, dude, like, opened it up and was like, let's fucking win. Money we have, Super Bowl we don't. Let's fucking remember my dad. And brought in coaches, brought in stuff, but they built a facility, dope kitchen, good food to win. So for me personally, when I went to the Chiefs, the fact that I showed up the first day and for lunch they had cold cuts, I was like, we're never going to win a fucking game.
Well,
and players didn't believe me. And I'm like, I'm telling you, if they invested in us and built a facility and we had a dope place to eat, players would win. And when you travel, nice plane, nice nice facilities. Like while people don't think that shit matters, it totally matters. It
totally matters. I mean, at this one job site, it was a phenomenal experience because it was so large. You watch the other trades. These guys were not on my... They weren't associated with me at all. They were another contracting firm, a landscape firm I brought in. And these guys would go to the gas station, grab a sandwich, go back, get on their phone in their trucks. And then who argued the most at the projects was their crew, that crew. Who created them? Who had the most mistakes hitting gas lines, whatever? And these guys ate crap, but they ate in their truck. There was no... And we had everybody. I mean, sometimes there's 12 of us eating in the, around the thing. And sometimes we had wine, a little bit of wine. Then I would make coffee generally for everybody at the end. And then at night we would plan, because some of these guys were flying in for like a 7-day install. And then at night it's like, where do you want? We're going to do sushi. We're going to go to the pub or the, you know, bar and grill, whatever. But to this day, that's what I'm known for, is like, I don't fuck around with food. And I don't fuck around with people's paychecks. I don't fuck around with food. And it has a phenomenal effect on bond, on engagement, et cetera. So just to summarize that team thing, it was scheme enhancement, raise the bar on the expectations, give them the tools, put some sort of strict parameter on it to get them into flow state, walk away, you know, walk away and literally let them go at it. And then you top that all off with phenomenal food. And that was kind of, it was a winning combo.
You know? Sounds like a CrossFit football seminars.
I know. I was getting a vibe.
High
expectation.
So one of the things for us as NFL players is like, we like to go to dinner and we want to go to dope places. And I was real lucky. Tony Gonzalez, who, you know, we ran around a ton together. Tony always liked to go eat at cool places, and I was more than happy to go and be his wingman. And that was always important for me. I always, I like trying new places. I like to go eat cool stuff. And so when we go teach across the football seminars, I would always tell him, be like, man, let's go someplace dope. And dude, we had some kick-ass amazing dinners, and I got a chance to show these dudes on the seminar, because we got to teach a ton of them. Not only some cool foods, but also some amazing places to eat.
All over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is always cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, dude, I was thinking like we were in a pub in Munich when we were there for Oktoberfest. And we're sitting at this pub, and it's, you know, the Nazi party started in the beer halls of Munich. And we look up and you can see where they chiseled out the swastika on the ceiling. You know, didn't remove the beam, just chiseled it out. I mean, it was cool as we were having like schnitzel and drinking beer. And then
pig roast.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. Yeah,
it was great. And then Argentina.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
So our host actually owned a trescaria. So we showed up and he's like, what do you guys want? I'm like, give me like the craziest shit that we would never get. So we had an entire three courses of entrails. It was like organs, stomach, anything.
Kidneys that, were like kidneys, pretty bad.
Yeah. Like, but they brought us out just plates of just like, it was like a barbecued stomach.
There was a lot of good, but the kidneys were memorably bad.
Well, just kidneys are always bad because it smells like you got to soak them in milk. My mom used to do kidneys in milk, but I like that stuffed liver and all that in pâtés. But it was incredible. And then all of a sudden, like once we got done with that, they started bringing out the muscle meats, and it was like everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like cuts that you never get unless you go to a butcher. So
yeah, no one ever talks about my buddy tells me, because I love feeding the kids, and like, you know, when the boys get done with the climbing gym, I'd feed them at 11 o'clock at night. Or when my daughter was pregnant, she wanted gourmet French toast at midnight. And I love cooking and serving food like that. And Jared always says that food is my love language.
Yeah.
And I think it is. I really do.
I completely agree on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Duffin was talking about his wife's cooking, and like, I practically teared up. I was like, it seems like the most amazing thing.
Uh-huh. Jealous.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
No, I mean, food's important. We were even just talking about the collective we just had. Maybe next year doing like a VIP dinner and like doing some stuff. I mean, when we would teach us, we would have, so our capstone event for Power Athletes called the Collective, but for years before we had this huge event called the Symposium. It was open to everybody. This is just for our Block 1 coaches. But we always had this dope VIP dinner. And then we started getting it catered, and State Classy Meats basically sent us like 100 of these like 40-ounce buffalo tomahawk steaks. And this like world-class chef showed up and cooked. And that's why we have that big cauldron out there. He cooked everything. Mm-hmm. And it was probably one of the best dinners I've ever had. Like all these people in my house, there was wine, there was food, and like some of the best steaks I've ever had. That was, still to this day, some of my favorite events are those meals. I'd love to do one of those again.
Right on, man.
Yeah.
Well, back to the training. A lot of our conversation was bringing into that transverse plane and the cool tools that you have. And you have this vision for combining stone and gym and your architect, like how your mind works. So explain to us this dream vision for gym. I'd love to help paint this picture for our audience.
Are you talking about the, what I called it, like the art gym?
Well, I know we talked about, I mean, yeah. the way that John and I met. Actually, I got me and Parsley, and I can't remember who the other speakers were, but Brian Foodlice put on this, what was it called, Freedom Event?
Yeah, it's like Freedom Rally.
Brian Saunders.
Yeah, Brian Saunders put on this event called Freedom Rally, and it was during lockdown.
September 2021.
Yeah, so he rented out this, the same place that Lindsay Matthews had her
Birth Fit
thing at Collective, right? So he rented that deal out. It was myself, Parsley, I want to say Zuby. You know, that guy, he's got a great Twitter. He's like a musician. He's J.P. Sears was there. And then two other speakers who I'm totally butchering. But the one guy I got that fourth turning from, which was an incredible book.
Mike Dillard.
Yeah. And so they asked us to come speak. Didn't tell us what we were supposed to speak about. So I was the obviously the least known person. So he asked me to speak first. And I got up and basically talked about, you've heard me say, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You have, as an American, the things that are guaranteed to you and the, you know, the government. Like, they love to ask, like, give us this illusion that they grant us these rights. They don't. If anything, you know, the maker, whoever it is, you're inherently given these rights based off of, you know, John Locke's deal. And the government doesn't grant us these rights. These are our rights. We have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the government's there to guarantee that they don't infringe upon our rights. So, like, trying to, I know it's completely different than people look at it today, but they had zero fucking right to lock us down. Like, and what was amazing was how people were so quick to, like, kowtow to this. And so the event was just basically telling people, I'm like, you have to decide your level of involvement. You as the individual have the right to decide what life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for you becomes. And I just, my whole talk was about personal responsibility, that you have to be an educated consumer. You have to be able to, you know, I mean, I'll steal this from Rob Wolf. You know, the greatest form of rebellion is being healthy and strong enough to not have to enter the healthcare system.
Hence the healthy rebellion.
That's why it's a healthy rebellion. The greatest form of defiance is exercise, physical health, avoiding sickness and illness, owning a home gym, you know, knowing where your food's sourced from.
I like that.
And so my talk was about these people. It's like, you know, you have all the tools available to you. Nobody is like you're waiting for somebody to hand this to you. No, these are your God-given rights. Like, the maker, whoever it is between you and him, this is who you are. These fucking people over here that are giving the illusion that they're controlling have zero fucking jurisdiction over you as an individual, based upon if you believe within the, you know, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and how our founding fathers put this thing together. And, you know, so that's how I met John. And then he reached out on social media and was like, hey, I heard you talk. And then that's how we developed a bit of a friendship. And then he was like, hey, I have this thing with Brian Kellum. Can I come build a wall? And I'm like, I got a lot of land and I got a whole bunch of fucking rocks. And then he shows up and he's like, dude, you do have a lot of rocks.
Yep.
He was thinking he was going to have to truck in the stone. I'm like, no, I got a plan. Like, there's so much stone around here. Like, I was just like, I did a, on Sunday, I walked down to the creek and then walked all the way to where that new bridge is, which is at our property line, and then went back up to the school and walked around just looking for rock piles. There are so many rock piles around here. Like, we could build anything. Yeah. Like it's amazing how much rock is here.
Two things we talked about was doing a workshop. That's one thing, doing a workshop, because what people enjoy, and this leads into that idea of what I kind of call, I had this idea in 2015 in Seattle, was a gym where you combine, it's a little bit off subject, but it's, I don't know if that's what you're talking about. It's a gym where you combine movement with everything that's built in the gym is built by craftsmen, because I have a high, I mean, I have a real focus on beauty as a human need. Beauty is, there's so much what I call, there's so much division, ugliness, and uncertainty in the world. So then my purpose is to bring order, beauty, and wonder and all. Those are two emotions. They're very important emotions. And I'm kind of doing this whole study right now, Sir Roger Scruton, and I'm listening to this other guy about beauty, the ethics of beauty. So then I always thought, like, because I had this outdoor gym I had up on this bluff above the Pacific, about 200 feet above the Pacific in Carpinteria. And I would go up there, I'd set up all my logs, my kettlebells, and I'd work out on this bluff looking over the ocean, watching killer whales, dolphins, surfers. And it was just, I was in this flow state of this. It was literally the best place I've ever worked out in my life. So one of the ideas I had one time is isn't there a way, and I don't know, is there a way to make a gym where movement is beautiful. It's not just lifting something. Like there's, and that has to be that movement has to have some sort of form that forces it into something beautiful. So I always had this idea one day of connecting with guys like you who understand, you know, the ins and outs of strength training, bringing craftsmen in to build things that are based off movement. But the whole idea is the person doing it is engaged in not just in art of movement or movement, you know, artistic movement, but also the outcome. You know, like the everything instead of concrete balls, they're granite, hand sculpted.
And metal, and then that was the other piece. So one of the drawings I did when we got done talking was I wanted to build a steel Conan wheel, like actually like have like a, you know, some form of like capping, like some form of stone on the ground, and then have like a steel spike, and then obviously come out with like a steel deal, and then make like a metal cart or like a basket where you could load stones in, and then do like Conan wheel. And then obviously like bending tubes or, you know, like a DOM and in terms of like this to be able to go up over and weld. And so being able to combine different medians of like stone structure like this, but then also where you traverse, where you execute one, and then you have to physically traverse to the other one using, you know, metal and stone, and basically build like an outdoor aesthetic training facility.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really super personal. You can have like my, like, canvas walls out that can move and flow. Because I think for me, I've always been, I mean, in the Marine Corps, I have specific moments, man, where the aesthetics, like one time we did this exfil in the morning out of the swamps, and we were in these rigid boats. And I remember we got in the boats and you had to sit on these pads because to protect your back. I forget what the kind of boats were. They had these twin outboard motors and the fog bank was down about 20 feet. And I remember just these boats, perfect. The coxswains were just going perfectly. I remember the rooster tails coming out of them and the sun was coming up. For me, it was like I was in moving art. And I, to this day, I can remember every moment of it. I was just like, no one's talking. We're all just going out of the swamp area, just perfect like that. Rooster tails, fog, light blue and all this stuff. It was just a real aesthetic moment. I had another one like that when we were doing this other practice mission at night. Had to do with helicopters. I just remember the colors, but you're moving. And so I always wondered, like, is it possible to bring all that into something? Because you're getting added to the physicality of whether it's, you know, if it's a strength training, is meeting the need for beauty. And I've thought about this for years because I think it's one of the things that's been under attack. I think it's so critical. But it's not discussed other than in like certain, you know, high academia. Like Sir Roger Scruton is just a thinker, but he's not mainstream. So now it's really more prominent. You know, especially since the whole COVID thing, is just how much ugliness there is, not just in the architecture of the 20th century, just ugliness, period.
Yeah.
And in
with the people too.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never in my life seen, people abandon humanity and like understand like the, you know, like this idea of like ideology and pointing fingers and this and like, you know, it's just so, it was gross. It's the only word I know for it, gross. Yeah. And I don't use that word very often, but it was fucking gross. And I think that time, like when I do some reflection back on that, the time I try to focus on was when we were in that lockdown and the fact that like, which I think was hilarious because we did brew with the crew. And then Luke basically like after the second one basically got sick and never did another one, but we just kept doing it anyway, which we should have just abandoned it because it was his idea.
I had a great time.
Yeah. But we got up every morning. We would just do like a kind of a live kind of like, hey, you know, here's day two of normalcy. We're just getting up early. We're going to bullshit a little bit and we're going to go back.
And our audience would have coffee with us.
Yeah. And
coffee. On Friday afternoons,
we would drink beers.
Nice. Beers so brew with the crew.
And, the thing I remember was that like my kids were home. Like I remember we didn't have Netflix. We actually bought Netflix. I finally paid for it so we could watch some stuff. We started watching, Heartland, which was like this horse show out of Canada that my daughter wanted to watch. And at first I was like, God, this sucks. And then by like, I think it was like the second week, I was like, what time are we watching Heartland? So like, we'd get run training and go do it.
I can live with it if you can.
And, but like, I remember how cool it was that like, you know, we got a chance to like really just kind of bond with the kids. But then we also live in a bit of a like a wonderland in that, you know, the whole world was locked down, but yet we still lived here on a ranch in Texas where like we still had a gym, we had all of our stuff. Yeah. It was just like the kids were home for the summer and didn't have to go to school. So I try to focus on that. But when I look at like, and you hear people, just even today with some of the narratives and like running in, like the, I went to back to school night and ran into the headmaster and some of the people from my kid's school that I got into with a little bit over some email exchanges on like COVID and the variants and this, and asking them questions on this and this, to the point where all of a sudden it just boiled down in these emotional arguments and I had to just fucking tap out, or it would have just got real toxic, and they're still weird about it. And I want to be like, see, like you guys were so emotional, but yet that was how we were being pushed into it. Yeah. And so as I think back on it, it just feels gross. But I do remember the cool part of being able to like hang at home with my kids. Yeah. So, but as we connected, the idea of doing a seminar and like really workshops to not only use piece of here of the ranch, cleaning it, you know, like basically carving out a place to build something really cool and then incorporate it with something within the training facility, a power athlete in the gym, and kind of do an interesting crossover where we do some physical training, teach some movement and some of the things that you're discussing in terms of rotation, transverse plane, frontal, sagittal, being able to understand, you know, unilateral, bilateral loading, and teaching a little bit of this stuff and then setting people loose to build something that's in lasting and something amazing.
Well, and it's like,
and I'm fucking in.
Yeah. It's like, how many, you ask a lot of guys in the dry stone world what they love so much about it besides the permanence of the outcome, you know, because I give a multi-generational warranty. And the only reason that I do that is to stoke someone's question. What do you mean? That means I'm giving you it. Basically, it's an unending warranty. As long as no machine comes in or damages it, you know, this has a three, you know, I'm building for 500 years. All it is meant to just get them to think differently. But you ask most guys why they love it, including myself, is the physicality. I mean, what else do you get to do where you get to be so physical? But what's the end outcome of that? It's something that just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And then you have the finality of the project and you have, so you're building beauty, you're building permanence through your physicality. So that's the idea for this workshop. I thought it'd be so fascinating is to, you know, bring people through more of an educated thing, like what you guys specialize in, but put it into, you know, it's a practical application. That's the word I'm looking for, practical application. And then it's people, if they could build like a portal where they're dude, basically wrapping stone
in a false form. It was, as soon as he talked about it, I sent him a picture for exactly what he's talking about, because I've always imagined on the other side of our creek, and I took you down there. Yeah. Like if you go down through the road through like the covered area and you cross the creek, there's an area between where our property line runs into this massive oak tree. It's been there. Like it's like this gigantic oak tree. It's 60 foot high. I mean, it's been there for, you know, let's say hundreds of years, right? There's an area between that I wanted to do it. And what's wild is if you stand there, you can see where the sun effectively sets within, no, I'm sorry. So when the sun rises in the equinox, so it rises in the east. So there's a where we can stand and I can watch where the sun, and I try to do this every couple of weeks. I'll go out there and just kind of stand and I basically can track where we are within the year, basically where the sun rises. And I thought it would have been super cool to like clean it off and put like a Stargate portal that allows you to see like the, you know, the winter equinox.
Yeah. The way you do that is on whichever day.
It's December 21st.
Or June 21st. You go out and the way they would do it when they built castles is they put a steel ring, and as the sun came up, they plant it.
Yep.
They plant that and they side alignment like you're looking through fixed sights. You know, and that's you would line that with the June 21st sunrise, and that's how you start to build.
In June, the sun rises right there. In the winter, it rises over my right shoulder.
So whichever one you want,
where in a castle? That would be the front, the back.
So the Vikings always celebrated the winter solstice
winter is coming.
Well, it was the shortest day of the year is the winter equinox. Solstices are the even days. The equinoxes, I think, are the longest and the shortest, right? Yeah, that sounds about right.
Sounds good.
Right, yeah. So the winter equinox, no, I'm messing this up. Hold on. Open your computer. Okay.
Well, if we make a rival gym to Equinox, we can call it Solstice. Solstice.
Yeah. So, but the Equinox, which I believe is the shortest day of the year. So the sun sets, because if you notice, every morning when I come to the gym, when we open that door, I always stand there and I look to see where the sun is coming up. So the sun in the summer is over here, and then it's basically over here to the right during the winter. And what's wild is from that spot, there's a clear view across the creek of where the sun comes up. So I thought it would be bitching to put the portal basically to commemorate the winter.
But yeah, you have a
solstice.
So they have that.
Or equinox.
You have that workshop, where people get to put in the practical application, what they're learning in a class with you guys, into doing a technique where they're learning the old sacred rules, because the old sacred rules are so amazing to understand. And what's awesome about building like that is no matter what the conditions are, no matter what your mood is, we had to build through the winter one time, snow, wind, no matter what the external environment is, no matter what your emotional environment is, the stress on, if you follow the rule, you could be under great duress that day in extreme weather. If you follow the rule, your outcome will always be beautiful. The rules, if you would, and this is, I think, is so cool about, kind of about life. If you follow those ancient sacred rules in Drystone, you can't help but have a powerful outcome.
Yeah, no, I'm, I love the idea. I mean, it was funny when he pitched it, I'm like, I got a perfect piece of land. We have a ton of available property, but I have such a cool spot. It's like one of the neatest places I've been. On our property, and there's just bitch and oak, and it all kind of set up. And as soon as he said it, I was like, man, it'd be bitching to have a Stargate.
Seven people.
And then I bought a, so if I scored a weld cap, he's like, hey, you got to make a cauldron, a fire pit. So I scored that and I sent it to him. I'm like, I got my first piece. Now we got to put this thing on and potentially push it out and get some dates done. And, I know set a date and see if we can push it out to people. Yeah. Because I think one, it'd be an amazing experience in terms of the training aspect, 7 a.m. from 7 to 8:30, we're going to talk about the training. He's going to brief the job site from 8 to 9. And then from 9 to that, we're going to go build this thing. And
eat a lot of good food together.
Yeah, and bring some cool food out. But how many people? You need 7 people per seminar?
7, if we're going to do it the way I showed you the design, it'd be for the portal, which is the big moon gate, it'd be about 10 foot outer diameter. It's 7 for that. Once that's built, the patio portion with a couple side bench walls, mm-hmm. 7. And then if there's a spot down there, one of the greatest things to build besides the portal is a freestanding wall. It's magic to build a freestanding wall with the bond stones. They're called through stones, 7. And the reason why is when you do a workshop like that, that's how I got into this. I did a workshop in 2008. We built a 40-foot bridge at a stone yard with two master masons from Ireland and Ottawa. And it was a 5-day experience, immersive, and that's where I discovered this whole field. And the immersion portion all the way to completion is important. And the way you immerse people is you don't have too many of them. Mm. That means everyone stays busy. Some people stay busy, whether it's 5 days or 2 weekends. They stay busy, but they have to be there for the outcome. And the outcome on a portal is once you set the keystone in, that's the top stone, and then the side pieces. When you pull your false work, that's your woodwork that you're building around, I don't care who you are, that is a powerful moment, because you're defying, but I like to say you're working with gravity. Mm-hmm. So your whole feature is in a constant state of falling, but because you learn to harness gravity as it's, you can look at it different ways. It's really magical. So always 7 people allows for everyone to stay busy, allows for me to make sure everyone's getting something powerful out of it, because you want that immersion, that flow state. Flow state to me is really, I achieve it a lot with stonework. And when you're in flow state with stonework, it's like one of the most awesome experiences. So 7, start with the portal. Once that's built, then the patio, 7 people. And then it becomes power athletes, hangout.
Yeah.
Hangout area.
But go over there.
Do sacrifices.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say that we're going to sacrifice people.
Pigs.
No, pigs, but pigs. I was imagining they would be cool to actually do a spit roast. We could, cause with the cauldron and the design I wanted to do is, I wanted the ability to be able to move it up and down, and I got some other cool ideas, but I thought it would be bitching to be able to actually set it up in the stone and be able to do a spit roast, which we could, you know, kill a pig, skin the pig, gut the pig,
or
spit
roast a collective dinner. Who knows?
Dude, that would be in a perfect world. Like, have the whole thing set up, put like hanging torches and like, you know, some fire stuff, and actually have like a bitchin' cocktail party out there.
Yeah,
I'm in. I want to learn.
Know how you like deadlines?
I love it. I do like the idea of learning
the collective.
Yeah, October or September rather. But I mean, I'm just more fascinated by. Actually, the practical application of like the training stuff that we deal with, and then being able to like take that and be like, okay, hey, this is what we're moving in terms of like this type of loading. This is the movement pattern. Now let's go out and actually use it within a real setting, like within the building stuff. That seems like such a rich experience to me.
And the parallels to sport at the highest levels we've seen it. So such finesse and perfection within a skill set. That then is built upon a fundamental and a foundational of movement.
And the wildest thing is we have so many rock piles around this ranch. It's the craziest thing. Like when you showed up, I was like, no, I got a bunch of rocks. And you're like, holy shit, you do have a bunch of rocks. Like there's random piles of rocks.
But then
I'm
what's
like,
great about that is put people who aren't real bodily aware or have good stabilizer muscle awareness. I call them stabilizer. And load a single wheelbarrow up with rock, and it's a little bit offset, and have them go over rough terrain, and you'll find people's capacity.
They figure it out real quick.
Fast. They either can't control and they dump, or people. It's great. Just a wheelbarrow of rock. I've always wanted to do stone games. Actually, stone games. You know, that are based on skill set, but also on prowess.
So Louis like Simmons had a bitchin' wheelbarrow. I don't know if Tex, you didn't see it, but they basically had like looked like a concrete wheel almost. And then what they did is they obviously had some form of like capture, and then they welded two pipes to it, and then had like a bat like a deal with like, I want to say some expanded metal. So when you lifted it up, I mean obviously the thing was fucking heavy, but you could load stuff within the center. I mean, it was like an antique wheelbarrow, what probably would, a 1,000 years ago they used before the, you know, with the wheel. But like that thing, I remember when we first went out there to Westside, Louis busted that thing out. And I'm like, this is like the hamster wheel of death. And so when he starts talking about these wheelbarrows, I'm like, we could make some shit.
Yeah. Well, and then, you know, and that's part of the fun and for people to do these. Cause this would be like, a workshop like this would be...
How many days? You said 5 days, so we'd have to do like a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday kind of a deal?
I think if I planned it right and did some of the pre-staging of stuff, 5 days, full days or 2 weekends. but it could be like the precursor to one day this art gym.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I look forward to... you finding somebody who's like, I want you to build this outdoor training space because I got a ton of ideas. And I think between, you know, the stuff that we do with metal and you do with stone, I think we could do a really neat combination of something that just will last a long, long time.
Yeah.
Have you been to the Stark Center in Austin?
No.
So it's the Museum of Physical Culture, mm-hmm. something along those lines. It's at UT's football stadium.
So they have all the old strongman equipment, and I left and actually made a barbell, which is actually at Sorenex now. We donated it to Sorenex's outdoor.
Center?
Yeah. So it's a entire kind of museum of just equipment that they were able to get from like the turn of the century and pictures. And I left there with just like, I know exactly what I'm building. And we built this bitchin' barbell that we used at the symposium. We filled I took weld caps, like the end caps for big pipes, welded them together. And then, basically we sleeved a barbell, kind of made it, I mean, it came out super cool, and then filled it with rocks.
Remember that, video I sent you, the Pakistani, that doing that traditional pre-wedding?
Oh yeah.
I mean, just that, to me, the movement, his execution of that was beautiful. Like the, you know, from the squat, he had his long... And I like that guy. I follow this guy in Basque Country, Spain. He's a stone lifter. You know, they still do. So they had traditional, they developed sports off rural traditions in Basque Country. It wasn't just stone lifting, but these guys train now. They have leather pads, they roll, they train. but they're execution is flawless. And that's what I think, that's where the beauty comes in, is like that Pakistani guy lifting this, God knows, I don't know how many kilos it was, but it's so beautiful from that to the final one arm, double arm thrust. I don't know if I saw you that, but that's the kind of thing I think is what I'm after, is that's stone. That means that has its own story. How long it takes to do a stone sphere, it takes a long time. I got guys that can do it in Seattle. It's a machine that does that. And then you take that and you put the grips in it, and then you have to then, you know, maybe, who knows, a year. You know, so those are the kind of things I think about for a gym, is these kind of movements that are fluid, that are beautiful. But it's always in the realm of strength training.
Well, I mean, think about the Husafeld stone, the Denny stones. I mean, there's different stones that, you know, the Husafeld stone, I think, was there was an old priest that used to lift the stone to try to block the sheep pen. And like the dude was super strong, and then that became a strongman event. And, you know, or the Denny stones, you go out and you know, they have the rings on them. But I mean, there's a reason that people travel all over the world and these things exist. So, I mean, who was it? Ed Costner, where we talked about, there were the fisherman stones on the beach. So as a fisherman, you showed up, and if you could lift the stone, you got a full portion of pay. If you could lift the next stone, it was a half, a quarter. And then if you couldn't lift any of the stones, you were considered worthless and couldn't get on the boat. So that was how they gauged pay, was how much you could lift. So, I mean, this is something extremely primal within our DNA, you know, the idea of building something structure, but being able to incorporate it with actually some interesting fun training and going and building something amazing with a ton of the rocks that we have that are natives to this ranch in this area. It seems like an amazing opportunity, man. I'm excited for it. We just got to push it out to the world and see if we can get just seven people,
man.
Well, I guess technically five, right? One,
two. I'm in.
Five more.
Yeah. We just got to get some more.
I don't
more.
Count in that seven.
Yeah.
Right on, man.
Yeah, we're in. But no, it seems like a good time. But at the end of the day too, I'd love to have more, like if we had seven people there and we get to teach this and actually just be able to be there and help, but like, you know, get involved as well.
Yeah, I want to acquire the skill.
I think it's super cool.
Wait till you, you know, I want people to experience things like using a tracer to split a stone by hand, or feather and wedges where you split it with a feather and wedge, you get to watch it crack. I mean, all that stuff's just, it's really, even if you've been doing it, it's still fun to be able to use carbide steel and a hammer and split something with a curved face, or just to split it because you need it. It's very super satisfying. Extremely awesome. Satisfying.
Well, cool, man. Well, we'll use this podcast. We'll push it out, and we'll push it out some, you know, within your contacts, and also the, you know, within our Power Athlete, you know, ecosystem. And
so the goal is before September 2023.
It'd be dope if we had a year to do it. Yeah. Think we got it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're in.
Let's do it, man.
All right. And that is another episode of Power Athlete Radio.
Bye.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.